Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. This event is part of our summer series, Crisis in Our Country. And we have Professor Timothy Hampton. He is the Aldo Scaglione and Marie M. Burns Distinguished Professor of Comparative Literature in French. And he's also the director of the Doreen B. Townsend Center for the Humanities at UC Berkeley. And he's here to speak about The Art of Conversation by Montaigne, one of the most famous essayists in literature's history. And we've had him here before. And so when the topic came up of what we could talk about this time, it was perfectly clear what was needed. Professor Hampton, thank you very much for coming.
Thanks very much, George. Thanks. Thanks for coming out, everyone, on this beautiful evening. So what I want to do tonight is talk to you a little bit about the French philosopher Montaigne, Michel de Montaigne, who, as you may know, is an exact contemporary or almost exact contemporary of Shakespeare, born in 1533. Shakespeare is born, well, not exact contemporary, but Shakespeare is born in 1564 and died in 1616. Montaigne is born in 1533 and died in 1592. But we know that Shakespeare read Montaigne because Montaigne's essays were translated very quickly into English by John Florio. He's also an exact contemporary almost of Cervantes, of Galileo, of Francis Bacon, and the distinguished precursor to Descartes. He's about 40 years before Descartes. So I'm just kind of placing him a little bit in historical context for you. So he's one of these thinkers who comes at the end of the 16th and the beginning of the 17th century, at the end of what we might call the Renaissance in the biggest sense of the word, and kind of right on the cusp of the beginnings of the modern era, the moment of the rise of science, the moment of the rise of Cartesian rationalism in philosophy, and so on and so forth. A couple of things about Montaigne's life, very briefly, and then I'll try and suggest why I think he's important, and then I'll try and walk us through a bit this essay on the art of conversation, of which you see a page projected on the screen here. And we'll, as I mentioned to some people coming in, there will be a short quiz on this at the end of the hour. So let me just say a few things about Montaigne. So Montaigne is a French aristocrat born in the southwestern corner of France near Bordeaux. You can visit his castle now and go sit in his library today if you want to. He was raised by a very learned and idealistic father, whose name was Pierre Equem. The family had recently been ennobled. They were a bourgeois family, and they were recently ennobled. His father raised him deeply steeped in the new ideas that were coming into France from Italy that we loosely group under the name of humanism. So the return to the study of classical languages, focused not on logic and dialectic as they had in the Middle Ages, but on the study of rhetoric in the sense of public speaking, conversation, the study of history, which was, of course, very important to humanism and still is, and the study of languages and the study of moral philosophy. So these ideas, which were the kind of hot new ideas in the 1520s and 1530s when Montaigne's father was beginning his family, were just leaking into France from Italy. Well, I should say they were leaking. They came thanks to the fact that the French invaded Italy three times over the space of 20 years. It's not by accident that all those Italian paintings are in the Louvre, right? They were first ripped off by the French at the end of the 15th and early 16th centuries, and then again another batch was stolen by Napoleon. And of course, as you may know, Leonardo da Vinci was actually brought to France by the French King Francis I in the 1530s, 1520s to basically help him develop military technology, not to paint paintings, but to do things like engineer cannons. And Da Vinci didn't ever did very much and died, but that's, you know, that's a risk you take when you bring in mercenaries. In any case, so there was this great vogue of Italian humanist thinking that came into France at the beginning of the 16th century. And it was merged with a kind of Northern European interest, which was happening at the same time, in a return not only to classical antiquity, but to the text of the Bible, right? This is 1520s is the moment of the rise of the Protestant Reformation. So the idea was not only do you learn ancient Greek and Latin, you should be learning Hebrew, you should be learning Aramaic, and so on and so forth. Not only to read Thucydides and Virgil and Ovid, but also to read, in particular, the New Testament, the letters of Paul and the gospel narratives. In this kind of moment of extraordinary intellectual ferment and kind of great bookishness, really, Montaigne's father decided to educate his young son as a humanist. And Montaigne tells us in the essays that the first language he spoke was Latin, that his father brought in a tutor from Germany who spoke no French, but who did speak Latin. So Montaigne spoke Latin before he spoke French. And everybody in the household was supposed to learn a little bit of Latin so they could speak to the young Michel in Latin, and his tutor spoke to him in Latin. So Latin was his native language. Another way of saying that is that he was being raised to be a kind of Roman, dead Roman before he was dead, right? And he tells us also in the essays that this was a great idea, but and then his father made the mistake of sending him to school, at which point his Latin became bastardized and completely corrupted, and he was no use to anyone thereafter. He was then educated in a very exclusive school in Bordeaux, and trained for the judiciary and for some kind of light life at court, which would have been completely appropriate to a nobleman at the time. He began practicing law in Toulouse, which was the local sort of regional parliament, as they call them in French. He there struck up a very close friendship with a young writer and intellectual whose name was Étienne de la Boétie, B-O-E-T-I-E. La Boétie became Montaigne's soulmate, and they exchanged letters and spent hours in conversation. And at a certain point, at a very early age, La Boétie died suddenly, as tends to happen in the 16th century. And Montaigne was just devastated by this loss of his friend. And you can imagine, I mean, it seems sort of silly. It seems sort of trivial to us now, perhaps, Montaigne's response. But you have to think about what it would be to be a learned, educated, this is for you, sir, educated scholar, writer in the southwest of France in the 16th century. I mean, there is no literacy. Nobody reads, nobody writes, and you're the only person within, 200 miles who even has any books. And La Boétie, who was from a place called Sarla, which is not too far, which is in the Dordogne, was not too far from where Montaigne lived, and they were these close friends. Anyway, La Boétie dies, and Montaigne retires from the world, quote unquote. Now, often the assumption is that he must have become a kind of monk. In fact, he wasn't a monk. And later on, he even served as mayor of Bordeaux. But he gives up the idea of having any kind of career in public service, which would have been the natural thing for him to do. And he retires to his chateau, and he kind of moons around. And nobody quite knows what he's doing, but he says that he's writing. And nobody quite knows what he's writing. And finally, in 1580, he publishes a book called Essays, right? And Montaigne invents the word essay. So in French, you have this word, the verb essayer, which means to try or to try something out. And it's connected etymologically to the idea of a balance. It goes back into the Latin word exagium, which means a balance. It's the same word that we have in modern English when we talk of someone, I mean, Northern California, we're familiar with this from the 49ers, from the real 49ers, of the idea of weighing gold, right? What we call the assayist is the guy who weighs gold, right? And his kind of motto was, or his seal was a little scale. and or a, an image of a scale. And so Molten retires to his castle. Oh, the other thing I forgot to mention is that he then carves on the beams of the ceiling of his study a number of kind of pithy sayings in Latin taken from the ancients, right? So he literally carves or has carved into his building bits of Latin. So he's surrounded by classical learning. And he sort of retires. You can go see these today. And he sort of retires and he starts writing these things. He publishes these things called the Essays, which are an attempt to kind of try out his own judgment on themes of the day. So they're often, especially the earliest essays, are often on sort of classic philosophical themes, right? Like there's the second essay is on sadness, right? There's an essay on solitude. There's an essay on friendship. I mean, these are kind of things that every classical moral philosopher wrote about. Cicero wrote about them. Seneca wrote about them. You name it. Plutarch, all these old guys wrote about these kinds of themes. And then as he goes on, he starts developing new kinds of themes. So that, for example, in the first book of his essays, there's an essay called Of Cannibals, right? Which is a hip topic in the 1580s, right? Because of the fallout from the European journeys to the New World, in particular in this, the essay on cannibals, which is the essay that's most often read today by Montaigne because of the interest in cross-cultural encounters and engagements with the other. And it's about the cannibal culture of the Tupinamba in Brazil because the French had had a short-lived colony in Brazil that had been driven out by the Portuguese. And Montaigne had read about it and reflects on the cannibals. And it's an extraordinary essay because he actually tries to understand the culture of the cannibals from inside in terms of their own logic of how their culture works. So it's one of the first examples that we get of a kind of cultural relativism. I mean, Montaigne is writing at a time where everybody assumes that the people in the New World are certainly barbarian, definitely destined for hell. They may not even have souls. They may not even be human. And Montaigne says, no. They actually have an extremely complicated culture that has an extremely complicated set of rules and customs. And so he develops this approach of a certain kind of tolerance toward the non-European and a kind of openness of spirit. Okay, he publishes these essays in 1580, and they make him very famous. And he goes on, and he then goes back. First thing he does is he goes to Italy, which every good humanist should do at some point. He goes to Rome. He suffered terribly from kidney stones, and he wanted to see if he could soak his way out of his kidney stone problems by going to Italy and hanging out in the baths, which didn't work. But he did go to Rome, and he got a souvenir. He got a souvenir piece of paper that declared him an honorary citizen of Rome, which was, of course, a big thrill for him because he was so deeply invested in the culture of classical antiquity. Okay, so he comes back, and then what he does is he takes his book, his essays, which are actually in two books, and he rereads what he's written a couple of years earlier, and he adds more text. He just basically glosses his own text. He almost never takes anything out. He simply adds more stuff. So he's reading along, and he says, "Oh yeah, okay, that makes me think of this. Oh, that reminds me of a particular classical poem that I read recently." So he puts a little bit of the classical poem in there in Latin. So the text is a bilingual text. It's half in French and half in Latin, partly in French with Latin interjections. Or he'll say, "Oh, that reminds me of something that happened to me recently." So he starts writing about what happened to him recently. Then he publishes a second edition of the essays in 1588, now with a third book, which is twice as long as the first. Then he goes back. By now, he's very famous. He's not, you know, forget the court. He's a famous guy. He does a lot of work as a kind of diplomat, pardon the expression, in the current moment, going back and forth between the Protestants and the Catholics, and I'll talk about that in a second. But throughout the rest of his life, he continued to sort of gloss his own writing, right? So he had this amazing, strange writing approach, which it's not about revision, because he never, as I say, he never took anything out. He says this never. He says I may correct, but I never erase, right? So there are a few typos here and there, but mostly he's adding stuff onto his text. So what's interesting about that is, first of all, that the text of the essays is in some way coextensive with Montaigne's own body, right? That when he dies, it will end, but until he dies, he's adding more stuff, right? So that's pretty interesting. The other thing is, of course, that it's like an amoeba because it goes in all directions. It's not like he adds on to the end of an essay to make it longer. He sticks stuff right in the middle. So you have a page here from the essay on the Art of Conversation. This is from a wonderful website at the University of Chicago, which has the entire text of the essays in French. And this is the copy of Montaigne's essays that was found at his death. So these are the last things that he added in, right? And you can see there are all these strange. So he occasionally takes something out or scratches something out to put something in that's a little bit better. But this is where he's expanding his own text, right? And what I love about, the reason I like to project this thing is that you can see that also he wasn't doing this all on the same day because there are different colors of ink, right? So he's kind of glossing it. So he's like, he writes something in on Thursday and then he goes back and reads it on Friday. And he says, oh, that makes me think of something else, right? So it's this kind of, it's almost like a hypertext. It sort of goes in all directions as a book. And what's fun for us modern scholars of Montaigne is that scholars have gone back and looked at the different editions of the essays, the different versions, and they've constructed a kind of modern text which tells you where and when he added things. So you can read, and in fact, I've given you some passages there on the thing. So there are little letters, A, B, and C. In this case, it's only B and C because it's from the third book, that tell you where he added stuff into the text. So you can read it when you read Montaigne. You can read him not only left to right, like you would anything else, but you can read him sort of archaeologically. You can say, oh, that's interesting. Here he was writing this. Oh, and that made him think of that. I wonder why he added that particular passage. So it's this kind of weird text that sort of goes in all directions. Okay, so that's the story. That's the story of Montaigne. So that's the story of the text. So a couple of things I wanted to say about why he's an important guy today. So I think he's an extremely important philosopher for us. And I think this is for at least four reasons, right? The first reason is that he is very interested in the ways in which classical culture, which for him meant poetry, philosophy, and history, can be helpful for life, right? He's interested in the moral value of history, right? And since we live today in a time of dramatic historical crisis, in which cultural tradition is either being obliterated by new technology or distorted by political propaganda, Montaigne's patient and slow engagement with the past and with the texts of the past is really important, it seems to me. It's very conservative in a particular kind of way, but it's a very useful counterweight to the ways in which a lot of our current life is going. So I think that's very important. That's the first thing. The second thing is that he's interested in the cultivation of the self. He's interested in working on the self, right? And he doesn't understand the self in the modern sense that we do. And this is why he's an interesting guy. He doesn't understand the self as the isolated, private, unique individual that we think of when we think about the modern self, right? The self has its own history, right? He thinks about the self in its relationship to the public world, its relationship to the political world. And for Montaigne, the private self is in fact problematic because it's so unstable, because we're victims of our urges and our appetites, and our bodies are falling apart, and we have kidney stones, and we might get murdered, and all kinds of stuff might happen. Whereas what should be anchoring us, he says, is the common public world, the world of the court, the world of the king, the world of the commonwealth, right? Or what in French they call the police, not in the police sense, but in the sense of the polis, from which we get the word political, meaning that public sphere. That is what anchors us, he says, right? So he has this real sense of the importance of working on yourself in your relationship to the public world, to the common world. That seems to me, again, incredibly important for us in our current moment. The third thing that's interesting about Montaigne is that he's a great philosopher of the body. You don't get that a lot in this essay on conversation, but in some of the other essays, there's an extraordinary essay called On Physiognomy, which is very, very beautiful. And the last essay, which is called On Experience, where he talks about his own body and what he learns from the fact that he is in pain all the time, basically. And that sense of him being someone who thinks about the body and for whom the body and the mind are deeply intertwined, that's a very, either very pre-modern or very post-modern idea, right? In the sense that Descartes came along 40 years after Montaigne and said, forget it, forget the body. I'm not interested in the body. I'm interested in the cogito. I'm interested in the mind that turns over on itself and that can think. I don't care about the body. The body is actually the problem, so let's get rid of the body, right? And in recent years, feminist philosophers in particular, feminist cultural critics, but also people who are interested in all kinds of other fields, disability studies scholars, people who are interested in critical race theory, have begun to return to thinking about the body, to trying to philosophize through the body. And in that regard, as I say, Montaigne's either pre-modern or he's post-modern. But he speaks very much to us today, someone who says you can't do away with the body. We have to learn from the body. So that seems really important to me. And you can see why, you know, Descartes would want to brush Montaigne aside. And the other person who really wanted to brush Montaigne aside was Descartes' contemporary Pascal, the author of the Pensée, you know, who was the great neurotic of Western philosophy and who just hated Montaigne. And he quotes Montaigne on every page of the Pensée. He's constantly citing Montaigne. And he has this great line where he says, what a stupid idea to write about yourself, right? Which is what Montaigne does, right? He says the self is hateful, says Pascal. Right? And Pascal was such an unhappy guy. And Montaigne's a kind of cheerful guy. He accepts who he is. He realizes that he's going to die. I mean, this is part of life for Montaigne. And this just drove Pascal absolutely, you know, bonkers. So you can see why people like Pascal and Descartes were really interested in kind of erasing Montaigne, right? So the last thing that, the last reason I think that Montaigne is interesting and important for us is that he's deeply interested in the limits of our knowledge, right? In the ways in which our knowledge is bounded and in which we are fallible in our attempts to make claims of certainty about anything, right? This kind of skepticism. And so he's interested in the limits of European thinking about the New World. He's interested in the limits of his own knowledge. I mean, he has a beautiful, beautiful essay, a tiny little essay of a page and a half called Of a Monstrous Child, which is about an encounter with a severely deformed child who was taken around, as often happened in the 16th century, by his family and sort of paraded, and you could pay, you know, whatever, you know, 2 francs and look at the child, right? And Montaigne does this. And then he writes this beautiful essay in which he says, what we think is extraordinary and unusual and monstrous is not monstrous to God. So there's this beautiful moment where he sort of projects himself out of this world and says, you know, in God's eyes, we are all, you know, we are all creatures. So he's very interested in the kind of limits of human experience and limits of human knowledge, but he's interested in exploring those and making use of them, right? And this seems to me extremely important. He also has a beautiful essay, by the way, the essay on cruelty, which is about torture, which ends with this fabulous discussion of the debt that we owe to nature and to animals and trees. I mean, he kind of invents the idea of eco-criticism. It's really extraordinary. Okay, so that's a bit about Montaigne generally. I would recommend a couple of books if you're interested in reading more about Montaigne. There was a popularizing book about Montaigne that came out a couple of years ago, about 8 years ago now, by an English writer named Sarah Bakewell called How to Live. That's a terrific book. She's a really wonderful writer and writes beautifully about Montaigne. So that would be the place to start if you're interested in Montaigne. There's a beautiful book by great Swiss critic named John Starobinsky, S-T-A-R-O-B-I-N-S-K-I, Starobinsky, this is Starobinsky in French, who wrote great books on everything, wrote a fabulous book on Rousseau. But he wrote a book called Montaigne in Motion, which is really, really worth reading. And there's a big new biography that came out just last year by a colleague of mine at the University of Chicago, Philippe Descente, like 850 pages. So I haven't read it, but okay. But I will. I mean, I'll at least look at it sometime. Okay. So let me offer a couple of quick context, and then I'll just say some things. A couple more quick context, and then I'll say a few things about this essay. And I gave you some passages that we might talk about. So I mentioned a little bit the intellectual history of behind the essays, that Montaigne is writing as a humanist trained person, a person deeply. Steeped in the in particular the Latin tradition. He didn't know Greek, but he read a lot of Greek literature in translation, either in Latin or in French. So he's deeply steeped in the classics, in history and moral philosophy, and poetry. But he's also writing at a moment where that humanist interest in bookishness is starting to wear a little bit thin. Right. And it's becoming a bit vulgarized. So, you know, you can buy paperback digest versions of Plato's dialogue and you don't actually have to read them. Right. And so there's a sense, there's the kind of idea of the sort of pedantic humanist who's, Montaigne says in his essay on education, I'd rather have a head that is well made than a head that is well stuffed. Right. So he has this kind of slightly sarcastic, skeptical approach to the kind of bookish side of humanism. And that's an impulse which is not uncharacteristic for his age. We can think of a book like Cervantes' Don Quixote, which is, after all, about somebody who's read too many books and doesn't know what to make of them. Or we can even think about some of the moments in Shakespeare's plays where there are discussions of classical heroes, and it's fairly clear that they don't really work anymore for a lot of what Shakespeare is after. So there's a sense of the sense that humanism is kind of growing old. That's the first thing. The second thing, which is really important, is that when Montaigne writes, he's writing at a time of absolute political collapse in France, right? So France, in the first half of the 16th century, France is a kind of battleground or test case for what's going to happen to the future of Christendom, right? Right. So we have the Spanish and the Italians to the south who are devoutly Catholic. We have these new ideas coming in from Germany, the Protestant Reformation, and we have the English, you know, who go over to the dark side fairly early on when Henry the Eighth breaks with the Catholic Church. So there we got Catholics here, we got Protestants here, and we got France in the middle. Now, during the first half of the 16th century, the French are kind of balancing. They're always kind of in the middle, as they are today, as a matter of fact, now that I think about it. They're kind of, we're on one side, maybe we're on that side, we're not really sure. And things come to a head in 1560 when civil war breaks out. And so the whole time Montaigne is writing, France is involved in a vicious civil war, a horrible civil war. Montaigne saw people tortured outside his front door. He was a Catholic living in a Protestant area. His house was invaded at one point and taken over. And of course, the year that he retired from public life, I mean, it was not connected to this, was the year of the famous St. Bartholomew's Massacre, when 15,000 Protestants were killed by Catholic fanatics. So this is a terrible time in which there was sort of no order. And so it's important to think about that background of violence when you think about conversation, right? Okay, the last thought, and then I will be quiet. I will be quiet about that, is to think about a little bit about what an essay is, right? So, and I gave you some little selections from the essay here. So the essay is a very strange form because it's not fiction, but it's not fiction either, right? It's invented, and it's usually... When I speak of the essay, I'm speaking now of the kind of personal essay that Montaigne invents, that we may be familiar with from the writings of someone like Ralph Waldo Emerson in the American tradition, who was one of Montaigne's great disciples. Virginia Woolf's essays are very famous. Today, Marilyn Robinson, I think, is an extraordinary essayist, contemporary writer. The essay is a kind of hybrid genre where a writer writes about his or her own ideas, but draws upon material coming from the outside. And in Montaigne's case, there are a number of building blocks in his essays. He may take a fragment of a classical poem, a bit of Latin, and he may start with that. or he may take some example from classical history. You know, once upon a time, Julius Caesar confronted so-and-so and did the following thing. What can we learn from that, right? Or he will take examples from recent history, right? What did Charles V do when he insulted the French king and challenged him to a duel? Or he may take examples from his own life. Last week, I was writing, and I met a monstrous child. Da, da, da. So these are the kind of building blocks, and he sort of juxtaposes them and puts them together in a kind of almost a kind of spatial organization. When I teach Montaigne with my students, I tell them to think about the essays almost as a kind of space, more than as something that kind of unfolds. Because if you try to discern an argument in Montaigne's essays, you're in big trouble. So don't try and do that, because you will really be unhappy. And I also tell my students, do not ever write an essay like Montaigne for my class, because I want arguments. I want like A, B, and C, right? Yeah? Introduction, A, B, and C, topic sentences, all right? No chance with Montaigne, because he's going in all directions, right, as I've already pointed out. So we think of the essays as, you know, this idea of trying. Okay, I'm actually going to...
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
That will give you more space. Okay, so let me just tell you a few things that Montaigne says in this essay on conversation. And then we can maybe work through it a little bit. So I made a little kind of map for you all, which may or may not be interesting, but at least it gives us some themes, right? So this is an essay which is in the third book of the essays. The third book of the essays often deal with political questions. There are a number of them that deal with political questions. Did you not get this document? Well, you're in luck, because we have a bunch more. And I can tell you, by the way, I can tell you that no state funds were used in the reproduction of this document. So Montaigne begins this essay by saying, "Well, there are lots of we're accustomed to try and take wisdom from examples, but he says examples are not very good. The best examples are negative examples. In other words, I don't learn from somebody who is virtuous. What I learn is from somebody who's really bad." Right? And I can say, I don't want to be like that. Right? If someone's virtuous, I say, well, I have to imitate him because he's generous and he's kind. And that's useless, he says. The best examples are negative examples, right? So he says, So this is where I come in, because I'm a pretty good negative example. So read what I say and don't do what I do, right? He has this great phrase where he says, we do not correct the man we hang, we correct others through him. This idea that we're supposed to sort of to watch those who are punished and not do what they do, right? Then he sort of shifts into a discussion of conversation. And he says, you shouldn't read too many books because they weaken you. And, you know, there's a long French tradition of the French are very bookish, but there's this long French tradition of getting rid of books. Right, there's the French poet Rimbaud, who gives up writing poetry at the age of 20, or there's the novelist André Gide, who writes a book in which he says, "Throw away my book." Right, there's this idea of getting rid of books. So Montaigne says, books can really be destructive. What we really need is conversation. Conversation is something that teaches us and exercises us at the same time. He says, right, and he says the conversation is like a duel. And he says, you know, I enter into conversation easily, and I try to have an open mind, and I try to engage with my adversary, but I also have to be willing to yield when necessary. Okay, and he says, if I'm defeated, I learn about myself, and thereby defeat becomes a kind of victory. And I'll just call your attention then on the second page here. I gave you a little passage here, and I'll just read it to you. He says, when someone opposes me, he arouses my attention, not my anger. Is everybody with me? Okay. not my anger. I go to meet a man who contradicts me, who instructs me. I give a warm welcome to truth in whatever hand I find it, and cheerfully surrender to it. And then you can see where he added this in, where there's a little C. This is something he wrote after going back and looking at his own text. And provided they do not go about it with too much imperious and magisterial a form, I lend a hand to the criticism people make of my own writings, and have often changed them more out of civility than to improve them, loving to gratify my and foster my critics' freedom to admonish me by the ease with which I yield. Yes, even at my own expense. However, it's certainly hard to induce the men of my time to do this. They have not the courage to correct, because they have not the courage to suffer being corrected, and they always speak with dissimulation in one another's presence. That's an amazing sentence. I take great pleasure in being judged and known. I take such great pleasure in being judged and known that it is virtually indifferent to me in which of the two forms I am so. My thinking so often contradicts and condemns itself that it is all one to me if another does the job. In other words, I can't keep my own mind under control, and I make mistakes, and I turn back on myself, and I contradict myself. And so I don't mind if people say, hey, Michelle, you contradicted yourself there. That's fine with me, he says, right? So there's this sense that conversation is a kind of exercise that's going to help you learn about your own limitations and learn about yourself and help you to correct yourself. That you become in a certain kind of way a self-corrector by not only the way in which the other person engages with you, but also the way in which you learn about your own limitations through conversation, right? So this is pretty interesting. And actually, there's a moment just before this. Of course, see, this is a problem with this kind of exercise, is that when I put down some citations, I immediately realized that, of course, the passage that I really wanted to put was the one just before that. So let me just read you what he says right before this. He says, contradictions of opinions neither offend nor affect me. They merely arouse and exercise me. We flee from correction. We should face it and go to meet it, especially when it comes in the form of discussion. At every opposition, we do not consider whether it is just, but right or wrong, how we can get rid of it. Instead of stretching out our arms to it, we stretch out our claws. So there's a sense that by engaging with the other, we learn how to rein ourselves in and correct ourselves. So I think important is this moment in the middle where he says, nobody else will do this, right? Everybody around me is a dissimulator, and people are not willing to take on being corrected. So I think we can think about that interesting characterization of what's going on around him in the context of life at court, right? We can also think of where everybody is a dissimulator, right? Montaigne is a guy who abandoned court life, where everybody's conning everybody else, right? Sort of like, you know, the West Wing. We could also think, and this is where, as I was thinking about this today, I'm wondering if this isn't more and more relevant. We could also think a little bit about the claims made by the Protestants to have a kind of absolute truth, right? I mean, this was Luther's great claim, right? Luther's great claim was, I don't need to know, I don't need the church, I don't need the sacraments, I don't need the clergy, I get my truth directly. I don't need to go through the priest, I get my truth directly from the man upstairs, and I have the authority to make statements on the basis of, you know, what I feel inside. That very strong break with external authority is, I think, maybe behind all of this. Okay, so that's the first thing to think about. Then he goes into, the other thing I want to say is, when Montaigne compares conversation to a duel, we should also think about that, right? So it's a metaphor, but we should remember that the French are famous for dueling, right? Even in the 16th century, the French are famous for dueling, and Montaigne is writing in the middle of a civil war where people are killing each other needlessly, often over points of honor, right? So we could say that's really interesting that he says, you know, that if we can take this idea of real world murder and transform it into conversation, then it becomes something quite different, right? So that's pretty interesting. How am I on time? Am I okay? Okay. All right, so that's the first point. All right, the second point, and he then goes into thinking about style, which is a very kind of strange move, right? He says the most important thing in a conversation is to make sure that you keep the order of things. Moltaire hate, even though his own text seems a bit chaotic, he's very concerned about disorder. And you can imagine why. He's living in a time of extraordinary disorder, right? Political, social, theological disorder. And Moltaire says, what I don't like are conversations that degenerate into shouting matches, he says. That is not conversation. Conversation is when we respect each other, we have a format, and we stick to the format, and we stick to the order. He says, in fact, that is when we really learn, because otherwise we just start screaming. He says, I could talk all day long, as long as the order and the context are respected. So there are a couple of ways in which we can think about that. One is, of course, to remember one of the ways in which people talked in the 16th century, ways in which intellectuals talked in the 16th century, which was often in, like I'm doing here, public declamations, right? Where scholars would give, you know, great speeches, right? Or small speeches. Either that or in these learned disputes, right? There's a tradition of what they call the disputio, where two great scholars will stand up and argue out a case, usually in Latin. Moltaire says, I hate that stuff. I want to have conversations with friends. I want to have conversations in intimate situations where we can talk to each other freely and frankly, but I don't want us to yell at each other. I want us to respect the order. So what, and he says, and this is what seems to me the most extraordinary thing, is he says, the truth actually doesn't really matter in the end. It doesn't really matter who wins the argument. What matters is that we have carried on this ordered, polite, but lively conversation. It's the form, he says, that matters. And he says this is the second quote I gave you. He says, he who speaks true can speak as foolishly as he who speaks false. So the issue isn't truth or falsity. The issue is foolishness or not foolishness, right? He says, for we are concerned with the manner, not the matter of speaking. My humor is to consider the form as much as the substance, the advocate as much as the cause, as Alcibiades ordered that we should do. And then he goes on, this is a little addition. He says, every day I amuse myself reading authors without any care for their learning, looking for their style, not their subject. Just as I seek the company of some famous mind, not to have him teach me, but to come to know him. Any man may speak truly, but to speak with order, wisely, and competently, of that few men are capable. Thus it is not the falsity that comes from ignorance that offends me, but the ineptitude. Right? So this sense that it's the exchange that matters. It's not the question of who has the truth and who doesn't have the truth. Because if we're interested in testing the limits of our own knowledge and the limits of our own ability to think clearly, what matters is the give and take, much less than one person possessing the truth with a capital T, right? Again, I'm thinking we can think about, in the background, we can think about all of these religious struggles where you have two sides, each one saying, we have the absolute truth, we're going to kill you guys because you don't have it, right? Moltaire says, no, that's not what it's about. It's about the give and take. It's about the dialogue. So that seems pretty important to me. And I love this idea that he reads things because he wants to get to know the author, right? He doesn't really care what the author says. He wants to kind of see his style, right? I mean, I think it's just a kind of wonderful thing. And there's one other little passage, right, which I just want to read to you, where he says, because one of the things that we learn when we engage in conversation is we learn about our own limits, but we also learn about the limits of other people. And he says, then it's actually an act of charity to point out to your friend when he's making a fool of himself, right? So he says. I do not mean that no man should criticize another unless he is clean himself, for then no one would criticize, nor indeed that he must be clean of some sort of fault. But I mean that our judgment, laying upon another the blame of which is then in question, should not spare us from judging ourselves. And then this is the important part, it seems. It is a charitable service in one who cannot remove a vice from within himself to try to remove it nevertheless from within another, where it may have a less malignant and stubborn root. So in other words, I can help you out by telling you that I think you're being a complete idiot, and your argument holds no weight. What's interesting about that to me is that he's moving now halfway through the essay from thinking about himself to thinking about a kind of larger world. He's saying it's an act of charity. It's this part of the social good to help your friends be better conversationalists, right? It's not only about me. So he's moving into a kind of larger sort of socio-cultural zone. So that's pretty interesting. And then he goes on and he says, I'm getting so excited here that I'm losing track of my little outline that I made for you. Right, so then he has this great kind of turn where he says, everybody likes to deceive himself. And he quotes a phrase by the Latin humanist Erasmus, every man likes the smell of his own shit. Actually, Erasmus, I think, says, he actually says, every man likes the smell of his own farts. But it's the same idea. And Montaigne says, we constantly love to delude ourselves, right? And so we need, one way we can get out of ourselves is by engaging in conversation when other people will correct us, right? And he says, at this point, then he turns on the Protestants and he says, the Protestants, he says, we're destined to live in the body. He says, the senses are really what determine who we are and where we are. And he says, the Protestants thought that we could do away with it by constructing a philosophy or a religion which was purely spiritual. It didn't have anything to do with the sacraments or confession or images or saints' lives or any of that sort of stuff. They thought it could all be in the soul. He says, this is not true. Montaigne was a Catholic, of course. We're destined to live in the world. We're destined to live in the political world, in the religious world of outward trappings and ritual and ceremony. Therefore, we have to learn how to deal with that. And that's what the art of conversation can help us do. Let me just make a couple of points. So then he goes on from there to offer a discussion of politics. And this is my third passage where he says, so he talks about how kings this is one of these wonderful Montaigne moments where he sort of almost takes the position, the perspective of someone whom he could not know, but whose position he takes through a kind of leap of the imagination. The same way he imagines himself as a New World cannibal, here he imagines himself in the position of a king. He says, dignities and offices are necessarily given more by fortune than by merit. And people are often wrong to blame kings for this. On the contrary, it's a marvel they have such good luck, having so little information, right? Then he quotes the Latin poet Martial, to know his people is a prince's greatest virtue. He says, for nature has not given them a vision that can scrutinize a whole populace in order to discern preeminence and to penetrate our bosoms, where dwells the knowledge of our wills and our best worth. In other words, the king is not omnipotent. He can't see inside everybody's soul. He can't tell who's leaking and who's not, right? He says, they must sift us, they meaning the kings, by conjecture and gropingly, by family, wealth, learning, the voice of the people, very feeble evidence. We commonly perceive in the actions of this world that fortune, to teach us how much power she has in all things, and because she takes pleasure in beating down our presumption, having been unable to make the incompetent wise, makes them lucky, as if to vie with virtue, right? He says kings are not particularly competent, but they're lucky, right? Because, that's all we've got, right, is luck. He says, in my deliberations, so then he goes into this wonderful theme where he says, what matters in life is not the outcome of your actions, but the intention behind your actions. Because he says, the outcome of your actions is largely due to chance, right? And this is a big theme in the essay. Montaigne will say, so-and-so was praised for being a great hero because he did such and such and such and such a battle. But in fact, what happened is he may have simply stumbled at the right moment and his sword went into somebody else's gizzard and it had nothing to do with his virtue whatsoever. But that's the way we remember it, right? So he's very interested in this idea that the way in which things are remembered or the external fortune or the external destiny of our actions doesn't really matter. What matters is what's inside of us, right? So he says, for me, I outline the matter a little and consider it sketchily in its first aspects. The heart and core of the matter I'm accustomed to entrust to heaven. In other words, I get an idea for what I'm going to write. I write it, and then beyond that, I can't control it. You put it out there, and somebody does with it what they do, right? It gets retweeted or whatever, right? Then he quotes Horace, "The rest leave to the gods," says Horace. "I will say more," he says, "that even our wisdom and deliberation, for the most part, follow the lead of chance." In other words, we're not as smart as we think we are. "In every way, events are meager evidence of our worth and capacity." And then he says, "And what I myself adore in kings is the crowd of their adorers. The deference and submission is due to them, except that all deference and submission is due to them, except that of our understanding. My reason is trained to bend and bow. It is my knees." In other words, he says, externally, we have to give obeisance to the king and to the whoever it is, but we can still keep our minds and our own ideas privately to ourselves. Okay, so in other words, we get from talking about conversation to talking about correction of the self to talking about a kind of correction of the collective world to talking about kings and what the authority of kings would be or should be. So what seems interesting to me about this essay is that, like a lot of Montaigne's essays, it starts out in one place and it ends up someplace quite different in a place you would never think it would end up. Then he says, "Let's talk about history. I've been reading," he ends up the essay by saying, "I've been reading the Latin historian Tacitus." Now, Tacitus is a good guy to read. If you're looking for something to read in these days, Tacitus is a good guy to read because he wrote the history of the most corrupt moment of the Roman Empire, the reign of Tiberius, right? And the annals, which he writes, are extraordinary, right? And Tacitus is often contrasted in the history of classical Latin history. He's often contrasted with Livy, who's the great historian of the rise of Rome. And Livy's a kind of public historian. He tells us what the battles were, who won, who did this, what the deliberations were in the Senate, da-da-da-da-da. It's a kind of public history. It's kind of history from the outside. Tacitus is the kind of intimate historian. He goes behind the scenes. He knows what Agrippina was thinking when she poisoned so-and-so. He knows what Tiberius was thinking when he had so-and-so put in a sack and thrown in the river, blah, blah, blah. So he gives us the kind of dirty underbelly of the collapse, the decadence of the Roman Empire. So And he's an extraordinary kind of psychologist and also a very gripping historian. So if you haven't read Tacitus, read him. And if you haven't read him recently, reread him. I was rereading Tacitus last night, and boy, it's really amazing. Anyway, so he says Tacitus is really the great historian, he says, because he tells us the private lives of people, right? He tells us what the great think behind the curtain. And Montaigne says, but it's very important, he says, to be able to talk about yourself. And he turns now to himself and compares himself with Tacitus at the end of the essay. And he says, and this is the last little quote I gave you, he says, "Not to dare to speak roundly of oneself shows some lack of heart." In other words, you should put yourself into what you write. "A stout and lofty judgment, which judges sanely and surely, uses its own examples on all occasions as well as those of others, and testifies frankly about itself, as about a third party." In other words, you need to be able to get outside yourself and see yourself from the outside and tell what your story is. "We must pass over these common rules of civility in favor of truth and liberty." In other words, he says, you have to tell your own story, right? And this is a moment where, in some ways, we might say the style and the meaning come together, right? He says, "I dare not only to speak of myself, but to speak only of myself." So this is Montaigne's claim, is that I only say what I know, and I only talk about myself. But of course, the essays range all over the place, right? But that's an example of the range of his interests and also the range of the kind of public dimension. He says, "I do not love myself so indiscriminately, nor am I so attached and wedded to myself that I cannot distinguish and consider myself apart as I do a neighbor or a tree. It is as great a fault not to see how far our worth extends as to say more about it than we see. We owe more love to God than to ourselves, and we know him less, yet we speak our fill of him. If his writings could tell us anything about his qualities, Tacitus was a great man, upright and courageous, not of a superstitious, but of a philosophical and high-minded virtue." And he ends by comparing himself to Tacitus. Okay, so that's the kind of structure of the essay. And I've drawn these kind of lines on the thing that I gave you. To suggest that there are these kind of symmetries. He begins by talking about examples. He ends by talking about examples. He begins by talking about conversation. And then there's an attack on the French for being more excessively interested in dueling, mm-hmm. right? So he ends by talking about conversation as a duel. Then he ends by talking about a duel. So there are these kind of framing dimensions. So let me just say two things about what I find interesting here, and then I'll stop, because it's time to stop. So what seems interesting to me about this? So why am I interested in this essay, right? First thing that seems interesting is we get the displacement through the essay of violence into conversation, right? Of dueling and war into debate, right? So this cultivation of the self comes through an acknowledgement of the limitations of the self. We get the establishment of conversation as a key feature of French social life, which, as you know, becomes very important in the 17th and 18th centuries, right? We get the displacement of a focus on truth, either political or religious, into a focus on exchange and process, right? And we get this emphasis on yielding and flexibility, which seems, instead of the dogmatic pursuit of the truth, which seems to me extremely important. So all of these things suggest to me that this is an essay that we should all be reading really on a daily basis. And on that note, I'll stop. Thank you very much. I went over a bit. It's okay. So
I'd like to remind our audience, both online and radio and here, that they're listening to Professor Timothy Hampton speaking about the Montaigne and his essay, The Art of Conversation. And obviously the bottom line is that we shouldn't worry about our king's competence or incompetence, but just wish him good luck. Huh? So who has the first question?
Montaigne batters his reader by writing so exclusively in precepts, bold and undeveloped.
Yeah.
Such as the one at the top of your handout,
right.
Book's Weakness.
Yeah.
I'd like to know what you think he has in mind there and why he finds the necessity of creating a false dichotomy with the art of conversation, one or the other, but not the two.
Right. So why does he use precepts in that way? Well, or why does he make that kind of bold statement?
Well, the precepts are just simply undeveloped.
Right.
The one that got a little laugh out of here that people enjoy the smell of their own excrement.
Right.
But it's undeveloped.
Right.
What's the point?
It's a quotation.
Yeah, it's a quotation.
It's a
quotation.
But
what does he have in mind when he says book's weakness? I don't get it. And full disclosure, I'm a bookish sort.
Fine. I'm a bookish sort too, obviously. So I think his point is that, well, there are a couple of ways to think about that. One is he's very anxious about a certain kind of excessive bookishness, right? A bookishness that is removed from the real world, right? So he talks in his he has an essay on education, which he talks about the limitations of an education that is disconnected from any kind of action in the world. So he says, I don't care if you've read every page of Aristotle. If you don't know what to do with it in your life, if you can't apply it to your life, then it's useless. Right, so I think it's about a kind of. I think what he's against is a kind of useless erudition, a kind of empty erudition of people who write 800-page books that are stuffed with quotations from everybody else, but never try to apply learning to their own lives. And I think that's the claim that he makes for himself: is I'm going to put myself out there, and I'm going to tell you how these things do and don't work. And often when he'll cite a citation like, or when he'll cite a precept like that, it's to give us a kind of anchor around which he can develop a whole bunch of other kinds of discussions, right? So he says, you know, every man likes the smell of his own shit, and then he goes into a whole long discussion. He doesn't develop that phrase, which he gets from Erasmus of Rotterdam, but then he goes into a whole long discussion of what it is to be obsessed with yourself, to not get out of yourself, and so on and so forth. So he uses those phrases as kind of hooks around which to build things. And I also think, I have a friend who's made this argument anyway, and people seem to buy it, that these precepts are often taken from other authors and often in Latin. And my friend George Hoffman at the University of Michigan has argued that this is actually a way of helping you find your way around in the text. Because, of course, there are very few paragraphs, and it's harder than hell to find your way around in this stuff, right? So he says, okay, you can. And this, when I teach this stuff, I say, okay, this is two. I'm looking for a passage that's 2 pages after the Latin quotation that begins such and such and such. So they're almost kind of signposts as a way of helping you find your way around in the text. So I think that's another thing he's doing with those quotations. Sir. Ma'am.
Thank you, Professor, for a brilliant, brilliant impromptu. Harold Bloom.
Yes.
Included Montaigne in the Western canon.
He did.
Because of his style.
Yes.
And his thought.
Yes.
Now, Montaigne is considered to be the first skeptic.
Yes.
And why, how shall I put this? We read him today because we live in an age of doubt, uncertainty. People think they have the truth. The evangelicals think they have the truth. Everyone has an axe to grind, a point of view. So we read Montaigne because he knew that, basically, right?
He was living in an era, a similar era of fanaticism. I think that's fair enough, right? Yeah, I mean that's why I read him. That's not why I read him. I read him because I'm a college professor and I have to. But I read him because no. But I'm it's interesting because I was not interested when I was in graduate school. I wasn't interested in Montaigne. I was interested in his countryman of the earlier generation, the fiction writer Rabelais, who is the kind of great exemplar of this kind of bookish obsession in early humanism. And I went to graduate school, wanted to write a dissertation on Rabelais. And at a certain point, as I was developing a dissertation project, my advisor said to me, you really should be reading Montaigne. He's the guy for you. And I said, I hate that stuff. I can't figure it out. And, you know, it's too hard and so on. So, but I have to say, it sustained me. It really is a book for life. And whether, you know, if I weren't a college professor, I would think it really is a book for life. And I'm with Sarah Bakewell, who says that, you know, this is a really important book, a really extraordinary book. And Emerson, I'm with Emerson. Sir.
At this point in my life, I've come to the conclusion that knowledge can be a license to be stupid.
Yes.
And I think that's exactly what he's talking about.
Yes.
Because if you're in your mind.
Yeah.
You're not with your true self.
Yeah.
You're with your ego.
Yeah.
And you'll never have a happy life because you're full of knowledge.
Yeah.
And you're not applying the knowledge.
Yeah.
And you're not listening to the spirit that you truly are. And I think that's what he's addressing.
He says, just to add to what you've just said, well, for one thing, he is, just to gloss what you just said, he is very skeptical about any kind of absolute knowledge, anyone who's completely certain. He says at one point, I think in the essay on sadness, only stupid people are certain, right, he says. And he, les fous, he says, right, crazy people, but dumb people. So he's suspicious of dogmatists. He's also suspicious of mysticism, right? And we can think about that in the context of the wars of religion, where you have people saying, I heard a voice from God, and the voice from God said, go kill those 20 people over there, right? He's very suspicious of anything that's sort of extraterrestrial, we might say, or divine. And he's often in political theory, he's described as being a member of a group of intellectuals in the late 16th century in France who were called the politique, the politicals. And the reason they were called politique is because their idea was that the religious struggles of France could only be resolved in political terms. In other words, they couldn't be resolved by the Catholics winning or the Protestants winning. There had to be a resolution which would focus on life in this world, on political life, on on developing basically a stable government, which is in fact what happened, because the French Wars of Religion, as you know, ended when Henry IV, who was a Protestant from Navarre, he was a Prince of Navarre, converted to Catholicism and was able to put an end to the Wars of Religion because he was half Catholic, half Protestant. He's the guy who famously said, Paris is worth a mass. In other words, if I have to go to the mass, okay, but if I can go to Paris, I'm in. He was unfortunately assassinated a few years later by a Protestant fanatic, but, you know, these things happen. But there was this sense that the peace of France had to be created in political terms and couldn't be created in theological terms. It couldn't be a theological solution, it had to be a political solution, which, you know, goes to this idea that Montaigne is very suspicious of anything that's outside of a world in which your ideas are tested in some kind of way. Ma'am.
One more question. Yeah, good.
Yeah. I've often heard it said that Shakespeare was the first modern writer because he took into consideration all the vagaries of individuals.
Yeah, don't believe it.
And what I'm hearing about Montaigne, who I have no familiarity with, is that he was very early on looking.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah. And in some sense, possibly the modern philosopher.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I'm being snide about Shakespeare, but he's very close to Shakespeare in lots of ways. So we know that Shakespeare read Montaigne, right? There's a passage in The Tempest where Gonzalo, who's the wise counselor, talks about how they're shipwrecked on an island, and he talks about how he would like to establish a perfect commonwealth, blah, 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 and he goes on and on and on about this, and everyone makes fun of him. It's cited word for word almost from Montaigne's description of the New World in the essay on the cannibals. There's stuff from Montaigne's essay on cruelty at the beginning of Measure for Measure, and I actually, on my little handout, I gave you an extra credit question. Where Montaigne makes a reference to Socrates. Socrates says that anybody, if a man found himself and his son and a stranger guilty of some violence, he should begin by presenting himself to be sentenced according to the law and by imploring the help of the executioner's hand to purge himself and do so second for his son and last for the stranger. In other words, Montaigne says, if there's a law, and you've done wrong, even if it's you, you have to give yourself into the law. And I follow that with a little quotation, which I won't read through, but which is from Shakespeare's Othello, where Brabantio is complaining about how Othello has seduced Desdemona by giving her drugs, says Brabantio. They always say that in Shakespeare. The fathers always say that, that their daughters have been seduced by drugs. And the Duke says, you know, even if it were my own son, and he went against the law, I would order him to be executed. I don't know whether Shakespeare has this Montaigne passage in mind, but I just threw it in there for fun. Anyway, yes.
He was obviously such a brilliant conversationalist. Does anybody recorded his conversations with the quote opposition or other people, I guess?
No, that's a great question. No, he did not, you know. So we know a lot about, one of the things that we know about, for example, Socrates, is that he had these students who, you know, who remembered what he said and wrote this stuff down. This was not the case with Montaigne, and that's just partly has to do with his lost friend, La Boétie. So La Boétie, the guy who died young, was his best friend, and they used to converse. And Montaigne says at one point in the essays, he says, I wouldn't write this stuff if my friend La Boétie hadn't died. So he said, you know, and we could think about this in terms of kind of literary genre, because one of the things that learned men do during this day, sometimes learned women, but mostly women, learned men, is they write letters to each other, right? You know? So we have the letters of Cicero to Atticus and blah, blah, blah from classical antiquity. Montaigne says, you know, what I would have done was written letters to La Boétie, but La Boétie's dead. So I don't have anybody to write to. So I'm stuck doing these kind of monologues. So the reason he writes essays is because he has nobody to talk to. So you're right. I mean, it would be nice to know. A fly on the wall. But we know that he was a mediator between the Protestants and the Catholics at certain moments during the Wars of Religion, that he was understood by both sides to be a kind of honest broker. And he writes about this in his essay on the useful and the honorable. And he was trusted by both sides, and so he was thought to be an honest broker, and he was a diplomat in that regard.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So ends another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 116th year of enlightened discussion. Thanks a lot for coming.